celebrating the music and movies of John Hughes.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
His use of music were really driven by story. You know, it wasn't like, okay, I'm going to stop down now and do an on-camera bit where I'm going to feature a band and play a song. It's like all of the music was really supporting story in some way. Like Ducky and the music shop with Pretty in Pink, they were all used in a way to advance story. And so the integration of the music, you know, was really clever in that regard, I think.
Welcome to the podcast Life Moves Pretty Fast, which celebrates the movies and music of the late, great John Hughes. I'm the journalist Hadley Freeman and a John Hughes superfan. And joining me, as always, is Tarquin Gott, the wonderful music supremo who was John Hughes's music supervisor and many other things on many of his best loved films. So Tarquin, what are we talking about today?
Pretty in Pink, which I believe is one of your favourites of John's.
It is. I think it's the most perfectly realised. I think it sets out to do exactly what he wanted. So were you working on this one with him, Tarquin?
I had met him on Weird Science, so I was beginning to work with him. You know, Echo and the Bunny Men was possibly my suggestion because I'd been their A&R man at WEA and I was a huge fan. But no, David Anderley was the music supervisor on this great love triangle. This film is a love triangle with two outsiders, which John used to call Zoids, and a rich, handsome hunk. That was the triangle. And it's almost one of his trademarks in that he often had the sort of most important other character was not the love interest, but the best friend.
Yeah. Which is kind of always his problem. He gets kind of distracted by the best friend and then realizes the audience cares about the best friend and is more interested in the best friend. So just to recap, for those who strangely have never seen Pretty in Pink, it tells the story of Andy, who is played by, of course, Molly Ringwald, who is a working class girl from literally the wrong side of the tracks. She lives next to a train track with her single dad father, who is played by incredibly Harry Dean Stanton, who is wonderful in this, as the depressed dad whose beloved wife left him and his daughter nags him to get a job, mainly in vain. Her best friend, called Ducky, played by John Cryer, who is equally poor and devoted to Andy. And she has a crush on one of the rich boys at school called Blaine, as Ducky says, not a name, it's a kitchen appliance, played by the beautiful Andrew McCarthy. Meanwhile, Andy works in a record store alongside her friend Alona, played by Annie Potts, who fellow 80s fans will know as the secretary in Ghostbusters. And Blaine's best friend is Steph, played by the man who I think is the sexiest man of the 1980s, James Spader, who is hilarious as the horrible rich guy. And that is the story of Pretty in Pink, and it's all geared towards the prom. From the beginning, we're told this is a big thing. Her dad is worried for her. No one's asked her to the prom yet. This is something the kids all care about. And she's waiting really for Blaine to ask her to the prom. So that is ostensibly the film. What stands out in the film for you then, Tarquin?
I think it ends up being the lesson, what you learn from it. Of course, this film famously had to change the ending because originally written, Andy ends up with Ducky, mm-hmm. John Cryer. But when they showed it to test screen audiences, the audience actually booed. And so they had to change it to Andy ending up with the gorgeous rich hunk. So the lesson, not intended by Howie, the director, or John originally, is that when you've got a crush on a girl, when you're their best friend, you don't necessarily end up with her.
Yeah.
It's a cruel lesson that many of us boys took many, many years of following girls around in vain to learn. But learn it we did. And, of course, he rewrote it under extreme pressure. He was already directing Weird Science. He was making that film. He was prepping Ferris Bueller. And then he got presented with this conundrum that the audiences just didn't buy John Cryer Ducky as Andy's love interest.
Perhaps, again, because of his training in the advertising world.
James Hughes, John Hughes' son,
was very accustomed to that test screening process and test marketing his work and did not shy from it. And in fact, even kind of embraced it, you know, especially with as his career went along and he was making comedies, you know, mainstream comedies, you're trying to reach as many people as possible. And, you know, what you would learn at those test screenings was very invaluable to him. And, you know, I can't say for sure with Pretty in Pink, the sort of lasting effect on him with that. I've never known for sure how he truly felt about that. You know, I know a lot of people point out that Some Kind of Wonderful was perhaps a sort of corrective to it in some ways. And there's maybe a degree of truth to that. But he was very open to kind of that audience reaction factor. He wasn't putting his foot down and insisting that they be a certain way. He understood that he was in a dialogue with his fan base.
Interestingly, the test screenings not only gauge the audience's reaction to plot lines and characters, but also to the music that was chosen. During Pretty in Pink, John found that some people had noted down they liked the music better in the previous test screening. Here's Bill Brown.
Oh, yeah, 100%. There would be so many previews that you would get people coming back, which was a testament to the movie, right? Because you're getting recruited and the person's like, oh, I want to see it again. You know, think about it. Like, you've been recruited, you go and you stand in line for 3 hours or whatever they make you stand in line. You have to fill out all these cards and everything. You know it's going to be a nightmare because you've done it once. You're at a shopping mall again and somebody walks up and goes, hey, you want to see a movie? You're like, what's the movie? And they describe the movie you've seen. I wouldn't want to sign up for that again. Like, what a nightmare. But obviously it was a testament to the movie where they're like, I want to see it again. So you go to the preview again and then you can't help but commenting on the differences of version.
It's interesting to think how the film would have been if the originally planned actors had been cast. If it was Robert Downey Jr. playing Ducky, I think audiences would be fine with her ending up with him. And also, it wasn't supposed to be Andrew McCarthy playing Blaine. Andrew McCarthy has this very sweet, soulful quality that does make audiences root for him. It was, in fact, supposed to be Charlie Sheen, who is an obnoxious jerk of a frat boy. And that would have made much more sense for Andy to realize, actually, she doesn't want this obnoxious rich guy. She wants this sweet, but also sexy dork played by Robert Downey Jr. But in fact, I think it works better with her not ending up with her friend. The film really sets him up as second best, the Ducky character. And he has that really great talk with Harry Dean Stanton, Ducky, in which Harry Dean Stanton says, "You don't just because you love a girl doesn't mean she'll love you back. Look what happened to me. My wife left me." And that's a very sort of powerful scene, not least because Harry Dean Stanton was such a great actor. But it's very true. Why should Ducky end up with a girl who doesn't really like him? And why should Andy just settle for someone just because he likes her?
Yeah.
So the film does work better as a fantasy. And in fact, in the end, Ducky does end up with, oh gosh, Tarquin, you're going to have to help me with
Christy Swanson, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Christy Swanson, who is also in Ferris Bueller. So she's kind of like the dream girl who appears in various John Hughes films.
I think I agree. And the scene with Harry Dean Stanton, Harry Dean Stanton sort of sitting there, they're in two chairs. And Harry Dean Stanton's very sweet in that scene and sort of, you know, looks after him and doesn't sort of say, well, you know, mate, you're dreaming. it's a great scene.
That scene also has two great John Hughes obsessions. One is class, which this movie is very, very explicitly about. Andy and Ducky are probably the poorest characters ever to feature in a John Hughes film, particularly Ducky. He doesn't even seem to have a bed. He just has a mattress on the floor. And Andy is extremely poor. Her father doesn't work. Their house is a dump. It seems to be some kind of shack. And Steph and Blaine are extremely rich. And that was something that John Hughes then kind of reacted against in the following film, Ferris Bueller, where the characters are all very wealthy, but nice. In this film, it's very much the poor are nice, the rich are horrible. It's a very class-led movie, more explicitly than any of his other films. And the other thing that that scene features is the whole film is about a parent who's taught by their child. Harry Dean Stanton has to be helped by Molly Ringwald. She has to help him get a job. She makes him coffee in the morning. She wakes him up in the morning. Now, that's kind of the least believable part of the movie, that Harry Dean Stanton, that character kind of should be an angry alcoholic, this kind of man yeah. who's been left, is bitter, you know, sits around in his bathroom all day. The idea that he's this very sweet guy who doesn't mind being woken up by his daughter when he's, you know, sleeping off a hangover slightly stretches credibility. And it is to Harry Dean Stanton's credit that he makes him believable. But that's a common theme in 80s movies, parents who are being taught by their kids, more explicitly, for example, in Back to the Future, of course. And this is very explicitly done in Pretty in Pink, where Molly has to teach her father how to live. And one of the things that is so great about the way John Hughes casts his film, or whoever casts his film, but John Hughes is, you know, overseeing of his film, when you have someone like Harry Dean Stanton and James Spader, both of whom are really very extraordinary actors, you know, Academy Award deserving actors. And they give it their all in this movie. Neither of them phone it in. And no. that really elevates the movie. There's no sense of kind of like an easy, cheesy teen film, you know?
No, he is a supreme baddie, isn't he? He's right up there.
He's so...
He's right up there with Ralph Fiennes in...
Schindler's
Bruges.
List. And he's so cruel in it. And I don't know why Robert Downey Jr. wasn't cast in it. I remember seeing him in a film. I'm going to have to look up the name. It's him and Sybil Shepherd, in which he plays the boyfriend of Sybil Shepherd's teenage daughter. But it turns out he's the reincarnation of Sybil Shepherd's dead husband. You can already see what a classic film this is. And I'm so proud it stayed in my head for 30 years. And Downey Jr. completely phones it in. And none of the actors in this phone it in. I, you know, as much as I love John Cryer and Andrew McCarthy, they're probably not Downey Jr. level. But still, you can see them giving it their all in this film.
Yeah, everybody, you know, came to the party, didn't they? So two things I want to say. First is script v. cast when it comes to making great films. If you can get a great script and a great cast, surprise, surprise, you get a great film. But so often there's a mismatch. Great cast, terrible script, great script, terrible cast. But because John was above all a writer, he fixed it.
Yeah, he did.
He rewrote the film and made the cast work.
Yeah.
And it's an extraordinary example. And it's a very public example because the novelization of the book had already been written and was at the printers and being made. So when the film came out, out came the novelization, and everybody read it and went, what? Hold on a minute. No. So everybody knew that it had been changed. I always feel sorry for John Cryer. It must be so humiliating.
So depressing. And what makes it even worse is at the prom, in the reshot scene that we see, Andrew McCarthy isn't actually looking that good. He looks a bit weird.
He looked a bit weird for a very good reason. Here's me reminiscing with Ron Payne, my right-hand man. Focus groups. We were talking about test screenings and how John would respond. And, of course, the biggest change that he had to make was on Pretty in Pink, which would have been just when you joined. You weren't at those test screenings, were you, where
yeah.
the audience... Oh, you were?
Yeah. And then, yeah, I had a screening, and that first screening where Andy ends up with Ducky... Molly ends up with John Cryer instead of Andrew McCarthy, and didn't score well, and audiences didn't want to see that ending. So I think obviously Paramount was there at the screening as well, and they saw the scores and the reaction. So Paramount funded a reshoot, a very quick reshoot. And the other thing I remember was, you know, Andrew McCarthy had wrapped Pretty in Pink and had gone off to his next project. And when he came back for the reshoots, he had cut his hair, you know, much shorter than what it was.
He was playing a soldier on Broadway.
Yeah, so he had like a shaved head. He has a wig on at the very end in the Pretty in Pink.
And another reason why the original version didn't work is that the day they shot the prom, this longed-for, built-up, huge event that the film is leading to, Molly was not well. She was ill.
Oh, no.
And she actually fainted and they had to stop shooting. So... she was feeling ill and dizzy, and she had to dance and be swung round by,
oh my God,
by Ducky. And, you know, he said it wasn't sexy. You know, she looked like she was about to throw up every time I sort of went near her.
I also think this is Molly Ringwald's best performance in all of John Hughes's films. She was very close to John at this point. They were going out, hanging out together, going to music gigs. And I buy her in this role as this girl who knows she's not, doesn't want to be part of the obnoxious rich girls, but still wants to be accepted in a way, while also staying true to her originality. I think she is really amazing in this role, considering how young she still was.
Like everyone says, you read it all the time, like she was his muse and whatnot, yeah. But they had a connection. They did. They were very well connected.
Jane Leigh, John's right-hand woman, PA, executive PA.
He loved writing for her. I mean, every one of his films made her shine. I mean, obviously it was her work, but it was definitely him behind her.
Suzanne Vega, whose music appears in Pretty in Pink, very kindly gave up some of her time to chat with me about her experience.
When you read the script, did you know who John Hughes was? Were you aware of Breakfast Club and 16 Candles? And what did you think? Because, I mean, as his music supervisor, I used to run into people who were like, no, he's too commercial. No. So I'm very impressed that you, being arty and from Manhattan, said yes. So thank you for that.
I think I knew of the films. I hadn't seen them myself. I wasn't really the age group. I think I was a little old for that kind of movie. And in those days, I'd studied film in school, but it was always the old classics of, you know, Marlene Dietrich and Humphrey Bogart and all those noirs and all of that. So, you know, it wasn't really my cup of tea.
It wasn't your thing.
But I read it and I identified with the lead character.
Strong female lead.
Strong female lead, also a very sensitive girl from the wrong side of the tracks, who's arty and a bit different, the kind of outsider girl. I knew that character. I was that character.
Yeah, I agree. A strong female lead who doesn't change to get the guy.
Right.
You know, and I think that was kind of a reaction from John. If he got any criticism at all for Breakfast Club, it was for the girl who does the makeover to get Emilio Estevez.
Is that the Ally Sheedy character?
Correct. This film was very much a reaction, a script reaction to that.
During that time, too, we used to go to a lot of concerts. Like, I think we saw, like, the Thompson Twins and what was the other one? OMD, the Psychedelic Furs we saw. A Beastie Boys concert and his sense of music, I don't know where he got it from or how he had it, but he had it and he could put the best piece of music with the scenes all the time. It was amazing. John sent the two of us. We went to a Prince concert. He's like, Molly wants to go to the Prince concert. You know, will you go with? I'm like, yeah, I'll go. You know, what the heck? So it was me, Molly, and I think one of her girlfriends. And of course, it was kind of hard keeping people away. Like, just let her enjoy the concert. Like when she got noticed. She was kept to herself maybe a little bit in some ways. I mean, I had a good relationship with her as far as, you know, chit-chatting, whatever, hanging out a little. But honestly, her family, her mom and dad, kept her pretty well grounded. You know, she hung out with her sister a lot. And this is only from what I saw, but I can't honestly say that, you know, she was a crazy diva or anything like that. Not at all. I think she was very... You know, I think she took it in stride, her celebrity status.
Sadly, it was her last film with John. This is apocryphal, and I do not have inside information, but one senses that when he asked her to do Some Kind of Wonderful, which we're going to discuss next, where he tried to sort of readdress this love triangle, she said no. Just as Anthony Michael Hall had said no to the role of Ducky, worried that he was going to be typecast. But Molly is an underdog and she succeeds.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's one of John's trademarks.
Now, let's talk about the music, because obviously the music is very important. What do you think of the use of music in this movie, Tarquin?
Well, where to begin? it's packed full of great stuff, isn't it? John would listen to Pretty in Pink while writing the script. It's a lovely song by Carole King and Jerry Goffin. And it's a love song about someone who can't explain their feelings, which is very much what this film is about. You know, Ducky can't explain his feelings to Andy, And Andy certainly can't explain her feelings to Blaine. So it's an entirely appropriate song. You can see how listening to it would help John to stay in the right frame of mind while writing this script.
And which harks to another trend in 80s movies, which is bringing in a song from several decades past. For example, Johnny B. Goode in Back to the Future. So there's already miming that kind of music nostalgia in it, while at the same time, the music around Andy and Ducky is about pushing things forward. We have OMD, you know, there's all the usual John Hughes, you know, all that kind of stuff.
The Ducky scene is another trademark, which is the set piece where somebody plays with the music. And in contrast to that, one of the other great scenes in the movie is Ducky lying in his room listening to Please, Please, Please Let Me Get What I Want by the Smiths, favorite track of ours and John's. And which perfectly sums up what he's thinking. You know, I just love this girl. I so want her. And the way that music reinforces the storyline and what the characters are feeling is what made the use of this music so great.
Yeah, yeah. And is that actually OMD at the prom? Because it's these two guys playing If You Leave in a very, you know, the audience definitely hears the song. It's very much a big deal in the movie. And we see these two guys on the decks. Is that OMD?
No, I don't think it is. But I'm going to have to double check that. And I'm now going to my chart of Hughes music inventory so that I don't make a fool of myself. Of course, OMD were on set. Ron Payne brought them to the set, as he describes in this sequence here. Well, talk us through that, the end track, If You Leave, by OMD, which is such a key track. I mean, I really admire it. David Andley, of course, was the music supervisor. I wasn't. But I really admire the use of tracks in Pretty in Pink.
So, yeah, when they shot the original ending of The Prom... John loved David Bowie's Heroes. So they shot that scene over a couple of days to Bowie's Heroes. And then Heroes was in the preview assembly for quite a while. And I remember OMD coming to the set. I'm pretty sure they weren't there while they were filming the prom scene, but they were there at some point during the shoot. I remember them coming to the stage at Paramount, looking like British pop stars that they were. And I know the story was they had another song and had to turn it around quickly. I'm a little foggy on some of those details.
That's right. They had another song in that they offered to John and it didn't work for John. And so they had to write and record overnight because the music dub was on the Monday. This was on the sort of Friday. And they had to write and record If You Leave overnight, play it to John, get it approved. And it was dubbed in the film on the Monday. For artists, is a deadline good or bad? Sometimes it's good. Sometimes not having time to think about and over-agonize and about something just lets you do it. So I think OMD has to be my favorite track from this, though now I'm feeling guilty about not mentioning New Order, who I thought were brilliant. I've already name-checked Echo and the Bunnymen and the Smiths. So, you know, I think that's enough.
And also he makes music a very central part because Andy works in a record store. So there's lots of discussions about what's cool music, what's not cool music. According to her, Lionel Richie is very not cool music. I would disagree with that, but that's just me. And there's always music playing in the record store. So he does bring music front and center. And of course, the Ducky scene with him miming Try a Little Tenderness anticipates Matthew Broderick doing Twist and Shout in Ferris Bueller in the next film. And the fact that John Cryer looks so much like Matthew Broderick makes it seem even more like a rehearsal for that scene.
They would play music on set. Marilyn Vance, the costume designer, has talked about this and how John delighted in playing new music, new discoveries to the whole set, to the actors and everybody. It drove him to work, if you like. Music was also used by John's film crew to lure him onto the set.
I shot a sequence of driving across country. So I spent 10 days in a Winnebago with a very small crew and we shot driving cross country. And when I got back and I assembled all the footage I shot, all of it was really beautiful, as you would imagine.
Of course.
But it was like an hour and a half of shit. So I was like, oh no, he's never going to watch this. Maybe it was Ron that helped me, but it was like the idea of just sort of setting it to music was really, really helpful. And God bless him. He sat through the whole thing. It must have still been close to 45 minutes to an hour. He sat through the whole thing and it was really kind to me about it. And there's one shot in the movie that's probably like 3 seconds long, which is fine. This is like exactly what I talk about him not being precious with anything.
When those Beatle bootlegs first started surfacing in 1989, the Backtracks and the Yellow Dog bootlegs, I'd found a record store that had them and I bought one and I was just like in awe. So I bought extra copies for John and he, of course, was over the moon. I mean, to hear the Beatles, you know, with their studio talk and different takes and to Can't Buy Me Love and Paul Flubb's The Words, and it was gobsmacking. At the end of each shooting day, you then go back to the little theater and watch dailies from the day before. And that's where the director would tell the editor, oh, you know, I like this take or that take or whatever. Over the years, it got harder and harder to make John sit through the second unit dailies. And the second unit is stuff that you shoot. It's usually with no dialogue. It's just traffic or establishing shots of cities or streets or whatever. And we had the hardest time getting John to sit through second unit dailies. So I said, I know how to do it. So in order for John to sit through watching scenes of traffic and establishing shots, we'd have the Beatles playing with like Can't Buy Me Love, Take Five or whatever. And John and Paul talking, and just all those fabulous bootlegs. So he would stay.
Record stores were such a big part of life with your father. And even in LA, you know, going to Rhino and Tower Records in the middle of the night and all of that sort of stuff. It was just great.
I can't tell you how much that carried over into his later life too. If he couldn't find a CD, he would just rebuy it. And then, you know, when he passed and there was an obligation to sort of comb through all that and make sense of all the records that he left behind. You couldn't help but laugh to yourself when you would find your eighth copy of, you know, Revolver or whatever, you know. There were certain ones that he just sort of always bought over and over again. But yes, that is very true.
He had this funny thing, you know, when he particularly loved a record, he'd have multiple copies of it because when he wanted to play it and he couldn't find it, he'd just go buy another copy. You know, I remember he had probably 4 or 5 copies of the Psychedelic Furs Mirror Moves, and he had this jazz album by Les McCann and Eddie Harris. It was like Live at Montreux or something. He had like 4 or 5 copies of that.
What had changed for John since 16 Candles and The Breakfast Club was that he now had A&M Records totally on side.
Right.
He had
right.
David Anderley, an incredibly respected music executive, as his music supervisor. And they were commissioning music for the movie. They were asking people to write stuff specifically for the film. And an example of that, this is an example of Molly's power, was the live band you see in the nightclub.
Right, right.
It's a group called the Rave Ups. Now they're in the movie, and one would have assumed they would be on the soundtrack. And I believe Ron Payne talked about that.
Molly was obviously the star of 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, and Pretty in Pink. So Molly's older sister, Beth, dated Jimmer Podrasky, the singer for the Rave Ups. So in 16 Candles, you know, she wanted to give the band a plug. So, you know, she's got her school notebook in a couple of scenes in the hallway at school, and she's, you know, done some graffiti, the Rave Ups. And then she holds it to where it's prominent camera placement. Everybody can see the Rave Ups, which is very clever of her. But then when it came time for Pretty in Pink, there were a couple of club sequences, and I'm assuming, you know, Molly said, hey, how about the Rave Ups? I'm guessing, I don't know. They appeared in Pretty in Pink in the club scenes. But, and this is Jane's story. So Jane's at a meeting with John, David Anderley, and Molly, and they're talking about the music and who's going to go what where. And John and David had kind of said before the meeting, oh, look, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to use the Rave Ups. So, you know, shtum on the Rave Ups, right?
This is obviously Pretty in Pink. And there was a meeting with you, John, and Howie.
And
David Anderley.
And David Anderley, yes. And Molly popped in, you know, for a little bit. So you know, everybody's talking about the music, this and that. You know, they're going through the whole album and the songs that are going to be on it. And they're reading through. And John says, oh, yeah, and the rave ups. And I'm like, oh, no. Oh, no, no, that one, that's not going to be in the album. And Molly's like, you know, her face. And John was like, and then David Angeles, of course, trying to play, you know, mediator. He's like, oh, no, no, we haven't made a final decision on that yet. And I was just like mortified. I'm like, you could have told me this is supposed to be their big break to be on the album, you know, the big, and it got cut. And here I am just, you know, like trying to be efficient, say, no, no, that's all right. They're not in the album.
I've got a really sort of silly question, a music question to ask you, Tarquin. Which came first, the title for the film or the psychedelic first song, Pretty in Pink?
The psychedelic first song first. They then commissioned a re-recording.
Right, okay.
And as is the way so often with these things, it happened to me with Everything But the Girl. In that case, we preferred the demo. In this case, the band didn't like the smoother version that was done for the film, I believe, and have always preferred their rougher version. But of course, this helped break them in America. And so, you know, they've been saddled, if you like, with this smoother, poppier, more commercial, more popular version. Oh, the poor things.
So what happened with Everything But the Girl? I want to hear that story.
Everything But the Girl, Apron Strings. It's a fantastic track written for She's Having a Baby.
Oh.
We tried to get it for the wonderful box set that accompanies this podcast, if you like, which inspired this podcast, and which, by the way, was just included in Billboard's top 10 box sets of 2022. Well, I never. Another song commissioned for the film was the fantastic Left of Center by Suzanne Vega. You being a New Yorker, you must be a fan or...
I love Suzanne Vega. I listen to her still all the time. I had no idea about her connection with Pretty in Pink, though.
I never met John Hughes. I met Molly Ringwald a couple of times. She came down to a show. I think she had suggested that they approach me to do it. I was already on A&M, so that worked out. They sent me a copy of the script. I liked the script. I wrote the song. And there we are.
Yeah. You already had some success with Marlene on the Wall in 1985.
Yes.
And you went on to huge, huge success with Luca and Tom's Diner in 1987. So this fitted quite nicely, I would have thought.
It did. Yeah. There was a mad scramble to actually get it done. They started off wanting just a simple acoustic folky song. And I wrote something like that with my producer, Steve Adabro. Then suddenly they decided, no, no, we want something hard-edged and remixed. And so they ended up getting Arthur Baker to remix it, which as far as you could go in the opposite direction. That was the journey there of the song itself in 1986. And so the soundtrack, as you know, was hugely successful. And it became a nice sort of stepping stone towards Solitude Standing.
When you read the script, had you done other movies before? Were you used to the process?
No, I was not used to the process. It was very early in my career. I had signed with A&M in 1984. My first album came out in 1985. So this was the first time I'd ever been approached to do any kind of thing.
Your first film, Sync, even, perhaps?
Yes, I think it was, in fact. The other thing I did that year was I had given some lyrics to Philip Glass for his sort of pop record. So he had taken my lyrics and set music to my lyrics. So it was a year of exploring, and my boundaries were pretty far and wide.
Did you go to the premiere in Los Angeles at the, I think it was the Chinese Man Theater?
Yes, I did. Yeah, that one.
Was that a good night?
Well, I had no idea where or how they would use the song. you know, when I received the script, I felt such a connection with the character. And of course, I had imagined the placement would have been different. You know, I was imagining the end credits with my song blasting out of the speakers and they would play the whole thing. And it would, you know, that was my naive vision of how it was all going to be. Instead, it was coming out of the radio while she and Ducky are discussing homework or something like that. And it was so faint that I thought, wait, is that it? Is that my song? And it's coming out of the radio and it's 20 seconds of it and then it vanishes. So I was stunned. I was like, oh, well, sure, they're going to play it again at the end. They're going to play it where the credits roll and nope. So I was a little disappointed, may I say that, but thrilled to be part of the whole project. You know, that was such a great soundtrack that I was very, very happy to be part of the whole project, but not so happy with the placement in the film.
As a music supervisor, I was with you. I would be depressed, you know, because you go to all this effort to get this brilliant song and you think it's magic. And by the way, may I compliment you on the song? A, the lyric, it's so great. It's so spot on. But the construction of the song is extraordinary. You go straight into the chorus. There's no verse. It's one very long chorus and then a kind of verse, not much of it. And then it's more chorus. It's very odd construction. Brilliant.
Thank you. In those days, I wrote things the way I felt like it. I wasn't really aware of the classic structures of verse, chorus, bridge, verse, chorus. So this was basically me and Steve Adabo in a room fooling around with the structure and the message and the idea of the song and the feel of it. I have Steve Adabo to thank for the fact that we have any sort of bridge or break at all is probably due to him. And it really, even now, hits a nerve.
Absolutely.
I've had young boys say, I love your song Left of Center. I've told my teacher that it's my anthem, you know, that it's okay that I am the way I am because there's a song about it on the radio. And, you know, this is fairly recently. So I'm really tickled. It was part of an album that went gold in the United States, much higher than my own album had done the previous year, which was huge for me in terms of my profile in the US. And it was a great soundtrack and it was everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, you could hear the Psychedelic Furs, you could hear the Nick Kershaw song, Wouldn't It Be Good? Everywhere. It was sort of pre-alternative days, so it was still called underground. At the same time, it was successful enough that you would hear it while you were shopping or while you were, you know, you would hear it on the radio, you would hear it everywhere. It was a thrill to be part of that.
It was sort of riding the zeitgeist, wasn't it, at the time? You felt like you were right on it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much music, and I love OMD and Psychedelic Furs deeply. I listen to them all the time still, particularly OMD. But I think I'm going to have to go for Left of Center by Suzanne Vega. There is something about Suzanne Vega that speaks to us girls of the 80s very deeply. Yeah, I went down this weird Suzanne Vega, this does not need to be in the podcast, kind of obsessiveness during lockdown. I was just listening to her so much and listening to Old Tom's Diner and all that stuff. And then I found out the kid in the Luca video is in Sopranos, is one of the main characters in Sopranos. And all my kind of obsessions sort of exploded in one.
Merged.
And now I find out Suzanne Vega and John Hughes. So yet another obsession. Boom. Turns out they're all connected. How do you get from John Hughes to the Sopranos? Turns out it's Suzanne Vega.
Suzanne Vega. I think that should stay in. That's gold.
So it was Dave Anderley who was the music supervisor, is that right?
David Anderley was the music supervisor.
And so who was he? So tell us a little bit about him, because obviously there were some amazing music people who worked with John Hughes, not least Tarquin Gotch and also Jimmy Iovine. So who's Dave Anderley?
David Anderley was this very long-standing A&R man at A&M Records in LA, who Ron Payne talks about.
I didn't know at the time. I just thought, oh, David Anderley, he's just a guy that works at a record company. Years later, you know, my interest in rock and roll history, and I didn't realize David Anderley was just right in the middle of the whole LA scene in the 60s with the Beach Boys and the Doors and Love. I mean, this guy was really well connected and really influential. So I wish I'd known that at the time. I would have peppered him with a million questions, but I didn't know.
The film goes out. They have a big premiere at Chinese Man Theater in Hollywood, and a lot of the bands attend. So a lot of the promo effort from Paramount is via the music. And the film goes on to be jolly successful. The $9 million budget brings in $40 million at the box office. So what do you think the lasting impact of the film has had, either on the world in general or on you personally, Hadley? Yeah, let's go with you personally. I'm much more interested.
It gave me a long-term love for Andrew McCarthy. The scene when they're in the library and they're texting each other sort of on computers using kind of early internet, and she stands up looking for whoever is texting her, and he appears behind the desk. He stands up. I still find genuinely one of the most heart-stoppingly romantic moments in movies. It's like Scarlett O'Hara seeing Rhett Butler at the bottom of the staircase. It's so romantic. He's so, you know, beautiful and so sweet-looking. You just want to eat him. And to be honest, in Molly's scenes when she's kissing him, she does look like she's kind of eating him.
The last kiss in the movie is ferocious.
They're eating each other's faces off. He is so ridiculously beautiful in this movie. And I think it did give those of us who are closer to Andy than maybe Gina Gershon this idea that we too could get the beautiful boy if we wanted to.
Quite rightly, and I hope you did. I hope you did. For me, you know, this movie was the third of John's teen movies, 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, Pretty in Pink. And the music, you know, it was the teenagers in middle America had woken up to the fact that, hello, these films are introducing us to new music. And I think he really did change what middle America were listening to and helped an awful lot of British bands have long-term careers in America. But if there's one thing I think it taught you is that, you know, it's okay to be a Zoid.
Yeah.
And not a Richie. You can find happiness if you stick to your guns and, you know, you're just a nice person. So despite the changed ending,
I do think that this film, more than any, set up the trope in teen films that the prom is the peak. You know, that's the thing that everyone's gunning for. There had been dances in movies before, of course, you know, even way back in It's a Wonderful Life, you know, Jimmy Stewart goes to the dance. But in this, it really sets up, this is the pinnacle. This is what you want. You want to be asked to the dance by a boy, which is a very, you know, trad, retro idea. But this idea that this is how you're going to end school. Everyone's going to see you. This is your fairy tale ending if you're a teenager, is to have a magical prom experience. And pretty much every teen movie since has riffed on that in a different sort of way, either making fun of it, like in Heathers, or kind of knowingly referencing it, like Grosse Pointe Blank, when they all come back and go to a dance all together. It's all about the prom. And, you know, now in Britain, kids at schools have proms, and it's become a big thing. And I think that is a major reason why this film, at least as much as Breakfast Club, still has so much cultural currency. It really solidifies that idea that the prom is something every teenager should experience. Annie Potts has a speech about it in the movie about, you know, if you don't go to your prom, you'll feel for the rest of your life like you've forgotten something. You have to absolutely go to your prom. I went to summer camp in the late 80s, early 90s, so just a few years after Pretty in Pink came out, and we were having Pretty in Pink proms at summer camp, this little Jewish summer camp I went to every year in Maine. And the girls would dress in pink and the boys would wear tuxes. We'd all have to bring them to camp with us. And I genuinely believe that the highest point of my life, way more than the birth of my children, is when I was voted prom queen of the Pretty in Pink prom.
Hadley, my admiration for you, which was great already, has just gone through the roof.
I mean, 12 years old and my life peaked at that point.
You know, I've always thought when I, you know, an A&R man, and I'd sign these young bands and they'd have hits and be rich and successful at 19 or 20. And I always thought how tough it was to deal with.
It is.
You know, the rest of your life being a downward curve. But 12, it's amazing that you've managed to survive, really.
I mean, there are long years of me just mainlining every prom movie I could, trying to recapture that high. But it was a huge influence right from the start, the idea of this big prom.
I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, American culture has seeped through films like Pretty in Pink into our world. I think it is extraordinary the way British schools now have proms.
How about Groundhog Day? That's been marketed around the world. Thanks, Bill Murray. I do think Pretty in Pink and the prom, I don't know if John Hughes was trying to satirize it a little bit, the idea of the prom being the fairy tale ending, but it's definitely been swallowed whole scale by generations still today. And when I was researching my book, which now is I was 7 years old, and I was talking to teenagers, you know, what John Hughes movies do you love? The girls all said right away, Pretty in Pink. That was always the one the girls love because it's still the fairy tale. The boys would go more for Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller, and they still watch them. Weird Science, too. But for the girls, it's the dream, the Pretty in Pink dream.
Oh, well, I want to just quote John asked, you know, why he did teen movies. Well, you have to remember that John, above all, was a writer. That's what he did. And then he realized that directors ruined his scripts. So he was sort of forced into being a director. And they said, well, why teen movies? And he said, because he thought if I had teen actors, they wouldn't say, what the hell do you think you're doing? Do you know what you're doing? And because he'd say, I'd be a first-time director. And of course, I wouldn't know what I was doing. But if they were teenagers, they wouldn't know what they were doing either. It was probably their first film. So he sort of stumbled into making teen movies for what I think is a very clever reason. And thank goodness he did, because, boy, what a great legacy he's left.
Yeah, completely. So next week, you and I will be talking about his last teen movie, very sadly, Some Kind of Wonderful, starring an entirely different teen cast with Eric Stoltz, Mary Stuart Masterson, and Leah Thompson, but also directed by Howard Deutsch, who directed Pretty in Pink. I think it's one of his really underrated films. So I'm looking forward to talking about that with you, Tarquin.
I agree, Hadley. And just to say, prom queen. 1984.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
So impressed.
That's what I'm here for. Now you know what you're dealing with. More respect.
And I think we really ought to leave the final words to Matthew Broderick.
I don't exactly remember when this happened. It was either during auditions or it might have been in New York when we were starting to screen the film. But I remember walking on Park Avenue with him, and he had in his pocket stickers that said, I think they said Pretty in Pink on them, or they might have said Some Kind of Wonderful.
Pretty in Pink.
Yeah. And we were talking about whatever, and every now and then he would casually stick a Pretty in Pink little ad on a lamppost or a storefront. He just was putting up little ads for his movie. While we were talking, I'd never seen a director actually put up his own little posters.
The box set, Life Moves Pretty Fast, the John Hughes mixtapes, is out now, released by Demon Music Group.
The Life Moves Pretty Fast podcast was a joint collaboration between Gimme Sugar Productions and Very Serious Comedy.